done it. You found the Debt Street Podcast, where our guests from across the financial landscape discuss their exciting careers, their hard-won insights, and how they are helping clients turn debt into assets. And now, here's Carol, to bring you today's episode with our special guest, James Lovely, consultant and expert witness at FP Expert.
Is someone who has built a highly successful business that is all about helping banks and financial institutions with legal compliance, structuring documentations, and being an expert witness. I'm extremely excited to introduce you to James Lovely from FP Expert. James, welcome to Debt Street.
Carol, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We're excited to hear about FP Expert, but before we dive in, I'd like to dig a little bit into your past. What was life like before you started FP Expert?
Well, I was born in Titusville, Florida. I grew up in Miami. I went to school at the University of Miami, University of Pittsburgh, and then for law school, the University of Virginia. So I moved around a lot in order to get my upper level education. Thereafter, I worked for a series of law firms and large financial institutions in New York, in Charlotte, and in San Francisco. And in 2003, I moved back to Florida, and I worked for a law firm doing derivatives work. And I also ultimately was hired to work as the CFO of a commodity trading firm here in Florida that focused mainly on orange juice trading, citrus concentrates. That was a great experience for me, but because the orange crop in Florida shrank so much from over 200 million boxes to under 60 million boxes, I ultimately decided to leave that hedge fund. And about that time, which was in 2010, was when Dodd-Frank came out. And while I was calling around, talking to friends, figuring out what I was going to do next, a number of people said, listen, we know you have a legal background and a compliance background. You've been on trading desks. You've run structured products businesses. We could really use help figuring out how our existing businesses will continue to operate in the new world of Dodd-Frank, particularly when derivatives went from largely unregulated to completely regulated. And so in 2011, I started being hired by different types of entities, one family office up in the Northeast, a regional bank in Texas, and I actually was hired on my first case as an expert witness by somebody who used to cover me when I was at Bank of America, and they needed an expert witness in a very large municipal bond repo and tender option bond case. So all this kind of came together at one point, and next thing I know, I was in business for myself as a consultant and as an expert witness. And here we are 13 years later, and the rest is history.
So it sounds to me like it was pretty effortless when you start this business. Kind of everything just kind of fall into places for you. At one point, did you feel like, you know, like this sole proprietor, a consulting expert witness business is going to work? Was there a moment in time where you say, yeah, this is what I'm going to do, you know, for the rest of my life, or, you know, for an extended period of time or something like that?
Well, you know, honestly, it was pretty easy. It was just a kind of coincidence of my background and experience and the opportunity and the fact that a lot of people needed help. And there weren't a lot of people with my mix of experience to help them. And so I always feel fortunate. I feel blessed that it worked out the way it did. On the other hand, you had the skill set and the background and the training to take advantage of it. But it's been a great opportunity. And every year there's new clients, there's new cases, there's new issues in the industry to deal with. LIBOR transition, swap reporting, Dodd-Frank rollout, whatever it might be. And it's been just a wonderful experience that just when I think I know what's going to happen next or come in the door next, something completely new happens.
So you went from doing orange juice to now you're heavily involved partially in the discussions of LIBOR transition. I don't think too many people can kind of tell that story. What do you see in terms of what your clients are most concerned about with the recent events that they are seeking help from you for?
Well, so obviously, LIBOR transition has been a big issue since at least 2017, and it's really coming to a head here soon, June 30th. And so a lot of people are wrestling with that issue, and I have a number of clients that I'm helping think through those issues and work through the different institutional issues, client issues, regulatory issues as we come into the crunch period here with the conversion of Eurodollar futures and options very soon in a few days' time, and then the conversion of over the of cleared swaps at CME and LCH. And then, of course, the full-on cessation of LIBOR at the end of June. The other issues that are kind of currently hot are the issues of that are going on in the banking industry generally. You know, a lot of banks are wrestling with the change in the banking environment for them, given Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, et cetera. And so that's raised issues for some people. And so there's always new issues, new opportunities. A lot of people are wrestling with enhanced swap reporting that came into effect at the end of December, and so that's another area of that's not your ordinary bread and butter kind of activity.
Yeah, I want to kind of talk a little bit about LIBOR transition. That's a hot topic, basically, for all parties involved in any sort of bond, or derivative trading in the interest rate environment. So my understanding is dealers can only trade daily SOFR at the interdealer market. However, a lot of the sponsored debt and derivatives are basically term SOFR. So there is a mismatch between the two. And I wonder if you can opine on as to why dealers aren't allowed to trade term SOFR in the interdealer market.
Right. So, I mean, you're correct that in the cash market, a lot of the legacy products that are being transitioned from LIBOR will either by contract or by law transition to term SOFR. In addition, as far as new products in the cash markets, particularly the loan market, there's been a very large uptake to move to term SOFR versus other variations of SOFR. There's been some use of SOFR average, but that's mainly been with the GSEs, the government-sponsored entities. And in the private markets, it's been a very large uptake of term SOFR. The concern that the Fed and the ARC have is what they call the inverted pyramid problem, where they're concerned that if a lot of product uses term SOFR, not just on the cash side, but then the derivative market follows, and you see a dwindling of the use of overnight compounded SOFR in the derivatives market and a growth in the use of term SOFR in the derivatives market beyond what is required to hedge cash market customers, that ultimately you will see what the regulators saw with LIBOR, which was a whole lot of use of term SOFR, but no underlying activity in term SOFR that supports that product. Because remember, SOFR is an overnight repo rate. The SOFR futures are not term SOFR futures. Term SOFR is derived by the CME from overnight SOFR futures. It's sort of a formulaic approach. And so they're concerned that we could ultimately have trillions of dollars of use based on no underlying cash term SOFR activity, either in the overnight lending markets or in the derivatives markets. Now, honestly, my opinion is they're right to be concerned, but it's indicative of the fact that for the cash markets, overnight SOFR is not a great rate. And it kind of calls into question why that rate was chosen. And the ARC has a very eloquent a story about why they used overnight SOFR in replacement of LIBOR. But at the end of the day, if the cash market's not using it, you got to question the utility of that rate as a replacement for LIBOR in the cash markets.
Interesting. So it almost sounds to me like they've gone down the wrong path and now it's kind of too late to come back and go somewhere else.
That's definitely true. I mean, what essentially happened was they said they would have a term rate all along, but they said they would only develop a term rate if they thought the overnight SOFR market would support it. And in 21, they kind of suggested, we're not going to develop a term rate right now. The overnight markets are not developed enough. And what you saw was a lot of people were unhappy with that answer, particularly in the lending market. And that's when you had the rise of BSBY and the rise of Ameribor and even the rise of Axie as potential term rates or term spreads. And all of a sudden, in my opinion, the arc pivoted between March and July and decided, you know what, we are going to come with a term SOFR rate. And that kept the cash market from bolting and going to credit sensitive rates.
I see. I see. That is the story. That's interesting. So if you were to actually pick, what would you pick as a perfect sort of LIBOR replacement?
Well,
what makes most sense to you?
I think that it would have been better for the government to work with banks to develop a term rate that was credit sensitive. And the big knock on LIBOR was always you didn't have enough activity. So all you had was indications to set the rate. And to me, the solution would have been potentially to require banks to engage in a certain amount of actual interbank activity in order to drive real data points and create a real rate. And given the fact that banks have giant balance sheets, particularly the banks that were LIBOR panel banks, mandating that they have a certain amount of their activity in term unsecured borrowings, I think would have been very helpful, not only for creating a LIBOR replacement that was based not on estimates, but on real borrowings. Yep. But also, I think the government lost a chance to use the rates the market actually applied to unsecured interbank borrowing as a signal that certain banks or the banking sector in general was going through stress. So just as an example, if a Silicon Valley bank had to borrow a certain amount unsecured periodically, and those rates were known to the regulators and observed, then in theory, the market would have signaled the increasing concern that rating agencies and private actors, researchers were expressing about Silicon Valley Bank. And that data point would have helped them realize, hey, the market's saying there's a problem with this bank. We need to act more swiftly to look into it and to enforce any problems that we see. So I was king for a day, I would have done something like that. I mean, some people feel that's kind of heavy-handed. But the reality is the transition from LIBOR has been very heavy-handed. The government's mandated lots of things along the way.
Yes.
You can use term SOFR. You can't use term SOFR. You have to have these fallbacks. You have to do various things at various times. So there's been a lot of government coercion and government control and guidance. And my view would have been, it would have just been better to use that to create the data points that would have allowed the creation of a LIBOR replacement in the United States.
That's actually an interesting thought. I mean, I guess two things. The government always saying that regulations is always the answer, right? Something is not working. Let's just regulate some more because that solves some kind of a problem, at least in their mind, which I don't know if I'm not so sure if I even if I agree, if they don't, if they even know what they're doing. And then like for like I see a point, like if the banks are actually borrowing
Right.
with credit, then we can see signs of distress. And I mean, it's kind of interesting. The rating agency are always the last one, right? After the sky has fallen, the rating agencies say, "Oh, by the way, we gotta change our ratings." 'Cause it's all over the news. They're always the last one.
Sure, but you also have people that recommend a bank stock and then the bank stock falls 40% and they say, "Oh, we're cutting our rating of the bank." So, I mean, things always lag, but if you had real data points, typically the market's going to give you the information faster.
That's actually interesting thought. So I want to pivot to outside LIBOR. You talk about the banking industry and what we're seeing in the banking market. In terms of kind of the top of mind from like a legal compliance perspective, like from your perspective for your financial institution and for your banks, after the Silicon Valley Bank crisis, what's like top of their mind now? I mean, obviously managing the risk is top of mind. From like your perspective and like in terms of their risk, are they coming to you with urgent needs?
Sure. Well, I mean, in general, this kind of activity is going to be managed, in-house by a Treasury department or some kind of centralized funding desk. But it's definitely the case that banks are facing a couple of areas of stress right now. One is because of monetary policy, the Fed waited much too long, in my opinion, to begin to raise interest rates and recognize the effects of COVID fiscal and monetary stimulus. And then they went from very low rates in early 2022 to nearly 4.5, now 5% rates. That was an extraordinary stress on the banking system. And so the problem that banks face is they're competing essentially with the US government, who's willing to pay people who have money. 4, 4.5, 5%. And yet banks are still holding deposits and even in many cases CDs at much lower levels. And so while the immediate crisis may have been squelched by the launch of the TBTF program and other soothing words and comfort provided by the banking regulators, over time, there's still this inexorable trend where people wake up and realize, oh, I'm getting paid 0.5% of my savings at a giant bank. I should just open a Schwab account or move money to the Schwab account I already have and buy treasuries. I don't have to worry about FDIC insurance coverage. I don't have to worry about waking up and finding out there's some problem with the bank. And I'm going to earn 4.5 or 5%. And so as long as that happens and deposits are leaving the system, moving into money market funds or brokerage accounts to buy treasuries, it's going to put pressure on the banking system. And the other big issue that banks still are going to face is an uptick in credit costs, right? Because banks, their customers are facing the kind of ongoing impact and margin squeeze from higher rates, higher energy prices. And so, and to some degree, a slowdown in the economy. And so, all those things are going to potentially start raising credit concerns and requiring banks to set aside more and more reserves for loan losses.
I see. So it's kind of like a double whammy. Almost like
Yes.
there's a perfect storm. You're running out of
Well, it's
deposits,
kind
now
of
you
like an
have no money.
avalanche, right? One thing leads to another, and next thing you know, more things are snowballing. And taking monetary policy rates from sub 0.5% to 5% in a year is super dramatic. And while lots of people have been throwing darts at banks and saying, oh, you should have been more aggressive about hedging and things like that, which is true to some degree, the banking model always involves taking some risk. And a lot of banks didn't actively manage their portfolio. They kind of laddered, right? They would say, okay, well, the loan I made 3 months ago, I wouldn't make today, but I'm making new loans today, so I get the advantage of the rate. The problem is, when rates jump so much, the pain that you have to suffer and the sort of time over which you can ladder to higher rates is too short. It's too compressed. And so I think the monetary policy folks didn't really coordinate very well with the bank regulatory folks. And as a result, monetary policy may be where the Fed wants it to be, but a lot of banks have been damaged in the process, owning treasuries and mortgage-backed securities that pay 1%, 2%, 3% in an environment where interest rates are much higher.
Yeah, and it seems to me like a lot of banks, they have like a program. So they just kind of have people follow the policy and just runs the program. But the
Right.
program never kind of baked in this huge shock of rate going up so high so quickly. The policy doesn't even address it. So even though like they might review the policy once a year, but by next year you toast it. You already toast it before next year hits.
Yeah, and
Right?
again, not to defend the banks too much, but if you looked at the dot plot where the Federal Reserve thought Fed funds would be out a year in March of last year, they weren't predicting that
No
interest
way.
rates were going to be at 4.5% and 5%. If you look at the
That's true.
stress tests that the biggest banks have to go through, those stress tests lay out assumptions in different scenarios, including a
I see.
severely adverse scenario. Well, those stress tests had interest rates, for example, 10-year rates at like the 2.5, 2.7% level. They didn't have them at 4%.
Five.
Yeah,
Four and
and
a,
so a lot of people have been kind of numbed or accustomed to the Fed kind of pulling the levers and steering the bus in such a way that they've been able to achieve the outcomes that they predicted. And so they put too much faith in monetary policy, and that bit them in the backside.
That's actually a good point. And it almost feels like they're just kind of waiting for things to break, and they just don't know what's gonna break first. So they hike rate more and more and see which shoe is gonna drop first, and be like, oh, maybe we've done too much damage. Or it's kind of interesting how they do things. Really, some people say we're in like one of the biggest experiment in the United States, because we have never had a Fed raising rate this quickly for this high. So, it's like the result, it's a no, because we have never been here before.
Sure. Yeah,
So
I would say that we're in about our third or fourth experiment in a row between quantitative easing and then the activities that were undertaken to kind of really change the monetary policy plumbing away from federal funds and using these different repo facilities to kind of control interest rates. And then you had the extraordinary activity in COVID, including buying corporate bonds and corporate bond ETFs. And now here we are again with a, as you say, a dramatic increase in monetary policy rates that have been an extraordinary shock to the banking system.
It sounds like we're in a free market, like free as in quotation free market. So going back to your business, when you talked about it was very much a natural progression. It just kind of things timing work out, and you started this business with kind of cl client coming through. Was there a point when you were running the business where you weren't sure if the business was going to survive, and that you have to find ways to pull through? Did you run into that at all, or was it really smooth sailing for the past 13 years?
No, I mean, I think with any small business, medium business, I mean, the reality is there are ebbs and flows in the business. You had a very important merchant energy client that, after a couple of years, decided because of the natural gas glut of some years ago that they went out of business. Obviously, for most people, COVID was quite a shock. I mean, when they shut down the entire economy, you're like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know if the phone's going to ring with new activity. So there's always ebbs and flows, but I've never really been too stressed about it because I kind of, well, one, I'm a little bit further along in my career, so I'm not as dependent day to day, obviously, on a paycheck. But more importantly, after 13 years, I've kind of developed some faith that, you know what, some new opportunity will come in through the door, a referral, a new client, some new development that requires your existing clients to adapt and re-engage you. A new case comes in the door that you think has merit. So you just have faith and things work out.
I like it. I like it very much. That's actually a good message. I think that applies to more than just a business or owning a business. I think it applies to life in general. We have to have some kind of faith that future will be better and things will work out.
Sure.
That's actually a great message. What makes FP experts stand out from your competitors? Do you have competitors? I mean, you're in a very unique space.
Oh, sure. I mean, to some degree, I have competitors. I mean, some of the larger swap and derivative consulting firms have people that not only do valuation and modeling, but do compliance, that help with documentation, that do lots of the things that I do. I would say the real strengths that I have is, one, I've worked in all facets of the derivative business: front office, in-house lawyer, outside lawyer, commodity fund CFO. And so I've seen a lot of different parts of the business, and so I can really act as a translator for my clients between their outside lawyers, their auditors, senior management, the trading desk, the back office, and I can kind of help facilitate solutions and resolutions of issues. The other thing I really pride myself on is I'm somewhat selective about who I take on as clients, but once you're a client of mine, I'm very responsive. So when people need help, when people call, I'm not getting back to them next week. I'm getting back to them in an hour, in 2 hours, and work begins for them. And people really value the ability to, have somebody be responsive who has developed knowledge of their organization over time and can really make things move forward more quickly. So I would say those are my two, the breadth of my experience and my sort of service attitude in terms of helping clients and getting back to them.
Yeah, for sure. We can totally relate in our business. We try to do the same thing. If client asks us a question, we try not to wait. I think for a bigger shop, they were like, "Oh, we're so big, client can wait. We got so many clients coming through." But for us, we're smaller scale. We want to provide top tier service. So that's definitely something that we can relate to on that front. Our client love a good story. Are you willing to share some of like the crazy cases that you have done, the witness work that our listener might find interesting? I'm sure you have a lot. It just depend on which one you could share.
Yeah, well, I can't get into like extraordinary detail about any case I've worked on, but as I said, on the expert witness side, I'm also pretty picky. And so my first question is, what kind of expert witness support do you think you need? In other words, are my skills and experience going to provide real lift to your case in terms of understanding the case and advancing your arguments? The other is, do I believe the side? A lot of expert witnesses get a bad reputation of they'll do anything for a buck, right? And I'm not doing this really for a buck. Yes, I get paid, but I am concerned about, does the client's side have merit? Are they making what I call reasonable arguments or straight-faced arguments that, if I was talking to a friend without any names, they would say, yeah, that person has a real point. And so I'm kind of picky about that. But as far as cases, I like cases where my skills help real people. So one example is there was a large public company, and it was actually public because it had so many employee shareholders. It had tens of thousands of employee shareholders, such that it had tripped certain requirements under the federal securities laws, and they were actually a public company. And believe it or not, this lady, she was very elderly. She depended on the stock of this company for dividends. She was elderly. She had held the stock for a long time. And somebody got into her house and stole the certificates and forged her signature. And they went to the company, and they actually got money for the shares, ultimately, because the company didn't have rigorous procedures, in my opinion, around securities transfers. And as a result, I was able to help the lawyer in that case and the client sort of formulate their arguments about why the company had a strict liability for not having followed certain procedures, and therefore the forged certificates were their responsibility. And ultimately, the case settled, but she was able to get money through her lawyer, and I felt really good about helping her out using my knowledge of security transfer procedures and the UCC. So it's kind of an example of having worked in a broker dealer. I knew a lot about securities and security transfer requirements, but I also was a lawyer. I knew a lot about the UCC, and I kind of synthesized that and helped the lawyer make the best arguments to help that person. That's an example. I've done arbitration work with law firms to help farmers that thought they were hedging and were relying on certain people to help make sure they were hedging. And it turned out that there were a lot of losses that shouldn't have occurred that were not hedging related. But that's just another example of helping somebody in the real world, you know, who had lost a lot of money. In one case, this person was actually put into bankruptcy, and being able to help them recover for mismanagement of the account was, you know, another positive thing. So I wouldn't say there's any super sexy cases, but those are the kind of cases I really like to help people with because they have claims, they have merit. I know a lot about the area, and I help somebody get a little bit of justice in the system.
I love it. Actually, they are great stories. We had a trader came in and he talked about, I mean, he got interesting stuff too. He talked about Jamie Dimon and talk about, like, you know, I guess the RM take the clients to a strip club and then get reimbursed for taking the client to a strip, you know. So actually, your story are much more kind of like your message of, you know, have faith that things will work out, you know,
Yeah,
much
like
more
I say,
positive.
I mean, I've obviously been an expert witness for big institutions too, where there's not a little old lady that needs help. But even in those cases, you know, the big client has had a real argument. Like somebody borrowed money and was claiming the derivative wasn't guaranteed under the loan documents, and the swap was not really structured correctly, and so on and so forth. And I was representing a large institution. But you know, big institutions deserve a fair shake too.
Right. It's all about being fair and have people doing things properly, correctly, ethically. You know, sometimes I think if you can set up a lot of laws, but that doesn't prohibit people from committing fraud and or not being ethical. So it's nice to know that there are lawyers like yourself who are advocating for justice and help the little guys. I think that's like so important. That something like you is it's here. James, a lot of the stuff that you do is really over my head. You know, I am in the derivative space, but the legal compliance side for banks and financial institution are nothing I've ever touched on, right? I help a lot of sponsors with the OTC derivative. So this is actually a very enlightening conversation. One last question I have for you. If you could recommend one book for our listeners, what would that book be?
Well, I mean, right now, I normally read history or nonfiction. And right now, I'm reading a book called True Believer by Eric Hoffer. He's kind of an interesting guy. He worked in the as a longshoreman in the San Francisco docks for 25 years. And before that, he was kind of an itinerant worker doing odd jobs all over the country, self-educated guy. But he wrote this book, True Believer, and it's been very well received. He's passed now, but when he wrote it, it was very well received by both academics and regular people. And it's a book about how mass movements, social movements get organized and get created. And so with our current political and social dynamics, I found it to be a very interesting read, and it's not super long because I spent a lot of time reading market stuff and regulation and so on. But This book's a couple hundred pages, but it has a lot of insights that are, in my opinion, useful for today's politics and society. So that's an example of a book I'm reading. Before that, I read a book, actually a fiction book that my daughter recommended called The Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. And I enjoyed that book mainly because it was the character development was very good. I like that book a lot too.
Wow. In terms of history, what attracts you about history? I personally love like history. I feel like so much of kind of the modern history is not really real history. So I'm always I'm on the quest to kind of figure out if what they're teaching me are real true, if that's if it's legitimate or, because people always say, history is written by the winners.
Sure.
And so I'm curious to hear what attracts you with kind of your interest in reading about history.
Well, I think for me, it's a couple of things. One, I like learning about real things and real people and real events. I was never a big reader of Tolkien novels or Star Wars or kind of sci-fi imaginary things. I mean, I've read some of that, but I always like learning about real people, real things, just because I find their lives and their stories more interesting and more engaging. In the music world, I listen to all kinds of music, but I really like blues and I like country music because I find the stories tend to be happy, sad, angry, whatever, wistful. And so I like real stories about real people. The other thing I like about history is, as the Bible says, there's nothing new under the sun. And so the more you learn about what's happened in the past, the more you can see echoes of it in the present and even in the future. And so you can learn a lot about current society and near future things by understanding what's happened in the past in similar circumstances.
Has humanity progressed since long ago?
That's a good question. It's above my pay grade, Carol, but I do think that there's a lot of the good and bad we see today is echoes of the good and bad we've seen in the past. Because at the end of the day, humanity is largely unchanged. Our strengths, our beauty, our weaknesses, our vices, they're all still kind of endemic. They're there today, they were there yesterday, they'll likely be there tomorrow.
I totally agree with you. It's history repeat itself. Maybe our technology have gotten better. Maybe our car are faster.
Right.
Maybe we have more rules and regulations, but we're still falling into the same trap, that same trick that been used in the past. And so it's interesting for sure. So I think that really concludes the podcast. I don't know if there anything else you want me to ask.
I mean, if people want to learn more about me, they can go to the website, fpexpert.com. There you'll see my consulting services, my expert witness services, talks about the kinds of areas that I have a background in. It gives you a summary of my bio and education. It summarizes the cases where I've been an expert witness, so you can see the kinds of cases where I've decided that I can add value. So you can learn a lot, hopefully, about me through that site, and you can reach me through the contact information there.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for being on the show, James. And for those who are listening, make sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a comment wherever you're listening. That help us to keep making the show better and better. And also make sure to send James your questions about her services. We'll see you next time on Dead Street.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening into this episode of the Debt Street Podcast, brought to you by Derivative Logic Incorporated. Derivative Logic helps you get straight to smart about interest rates and how best to manage your risks. Please like and share the link to this episode with your friends and coworkers. And subscribe to be notified of upcoming episodes. If you need to stay informed about interest rates, please go to www.derivativelogic.com and subscribe to the weekly Straight to Smart newsletter. Each edition looks at news and events of the past week, looks forward to important data soon being released, and briskly summarizes what it all means for you and your business. We look forward to welcoming you to the next episode of the Debt Street Podcast.